Welcome back, everyone, to our final pre-Christmas lecture this year. Quick repetition of what we did last week. We looked at the RSA signature scheme. We talked about group theory. And we talked about the Schnorr signature scheme, which is basically the Schnorr identification scheme. Plus the Fiat Shamir transform, which in total, as I said, yields in this case this Schnorr identification scheme, Schnorr signature scheme. There are a couple of related signature schemes that all are somewhat related to the Schnorr identification scheme. All of them are derived via the Fiat-Shamir transform, like EDDSA, ECDSA, and many other forms. Today, we close the trapdoor of signatures. We actually don't look at signatures today at all anymore, but we will close the chapter of group theory to prepare ourselves for the next steps. So we will first look at prime order groups today. And then we will start with public key encryption and key encapsulation mechanisms. And if we're fast enough, we start with the first construction, which is hybrid public key encryption. Okay, so let's not lose time. Directly start with prime order groups. So we have seen multiplicative groups last week, and we have talked about the order. Just a quick reminder, the order of the group is the number of elements in that group. So we have the order of the entire group. Now we also have the order of elements in that group. So for each element G in that group, we define the order of G as the smallest n such that G to the n equals our identity element epsilon, or 1, typically 1 is the concrete element that we use. So if the order of our group is prime, so if the order of group is P for a prime P, then first of all, G is cyclic, which means that there exists a generator G in our group such that the order of G is P. So we basically can reach all the elements in that group by multiplying this group element to itself. And all elements in G except for one, so except for our identity element, have order of G equals P. Which basically means that we can use all the elements except for one as the generator of our group. And we call this entire concept a cyclic prime order group. And now we come back to the comment that we have seen last week. So, an important note, we consider ZP star with the multiplication as the operation, a cyclic prime order group. But we have seen last week that the order in the exponent, so the actual order, is, and this is Euler's phi function, the actual order phi of p equals p minus 1. So this is a problem. Why is this a problem? Because p minus 1 is even. And this means that the order of the group that we consider is actually not a prime. So if we want to compute concretely in a prime order group in order to build that group, we have to use two primes, P and Q. And so this is the best approach that we are aware of. So we build a prime such that this prime is the result of the product of some r times q plus 1 for p and q r prime. And this means that there is some subgroup g prime that is a subset of ZP star, where the order of that subgroup is Q. So I believe you typically don't want to start a fresh implementation of a library where you implement prime order groups, but if you ever want to do so, you have to keep in mind that you just don't use ZP prime by just choosing a random prime number that is just large enough, but you have to make sure that your prime that you use for the cyclic group that you want to use a prime order of a prime number of this structure. If you want to learn more about this, take a look at the Katz-Lindell book on pages 339. And yes, there is more information. A second note that I stopped with last week was multiplication and how to implement that. Implementation of multiplication. Square and multiply or double and add, depending on what your group operation is. So we wanted to compute g to the x. Mod n. And it doesn't really matter if we compute this mod n, where n is the product of two prime numbers p and q, or whether it is a prime number itself, so we are in a cyclic prime order group. The idea here is just we want to implement the multiplication efficiently. So for this, we write our g to the x as g to the bn, bn minus 1, and so forth, to b2 and b1, mod n, where each bi is a bit. And all of these bi's are the bit representation, or the binary, of x. Then we can rewrite our exponentiation with x as g squared times g b1, this again squared times g b2, and so on, this again squared times g bn minus 1, and this once more squared times g bn. Modulo n. So this doesn't really help us in terms of doing something faster or smarter, but we can move our modulo reduction into the brackets. So we can actually write g squared times g to the b minus 1 less u mod n squared times g b 2 mod n, and so on. And the result is that the maximum expansion of the bits that we have to consider is looking at twice many bits as our modulus has. So we just, during the computation, we can always immediately reduce everything back to our modulus. And so we don't have to compute a super large number and then only reduce everything down to our modulus. This is the implementation of how we multiply in these large groups. Okay. Second bit that I want to talk about are the hard problems in prime order groups.
Question.
Yes?
You already square the first bit part already. So the very left
one, yeah.
The very left argument.
Mm-hmm. I think we do. Yeah. Yeah, loop errors are always the biggest problem of informatics, but I'm pretty sure that this is correct. So what we basically do is we move our one. So we have G to the one. We move it once left and multiply it with the bit that is directly next to it. Then we move it once left and we multiply it once more. So we basically always first move and then multiply. So we first double and add or square and multiply. Yes, please.
The innermost g squared is actually incorrect.
Okay.
Because it is a shift before the bit comes in, and I can show you the calculation.
Thank you so much. Okay, then this is probably, thank you very much for the discussion. It seems, so if you're very sure, then we just remove this one here. This is correct. It makes sense now that we say that.
That's exactly what I thought. Yeah. Also.
Yeah.
It should be something like G to up B1, G times 2, and so on, and so on.
So I will just follow your thoughts now, and I will verify it over the Christmas break. And
the other way around, exactly. The intuition is you start with the empty product.
Yeah. Yeah, I go, yeah, makes sense. Thank you for being very, it's nice that, okay. Yeah, thanks for being for observing and correcting what I do here. And now we come to the hard problems. So, hard problems that we look at in cryptography in prime order groups are the discrete logarithm. So x, the problem starts with an exponent sampled from our group, from ZP star, and then the goal of the attacker, A, on input of group element gx, g, and the prime, the goal of the attacker is to compute this x. So basically, identifying the exponent, or put differently, computing the discrete logarithm. And of course, whenever I write g to the x, I mean g to the x mod p. The computational Diffie-Hellman assumption well, the computational Diffie-Hellman problem is that we first sample two exponents. And the goal of the attacker is to compute the Diffie-Hellman key exchange g to the xy after seeing inputs g to the x, g to the y, generator g, and the prime. And finally, the decisional Diffie-Hellman assumption or the decisional Diffie-Hellman problem are defined as sampling three exponents x, y, z from zp star, specifying z0 as g to the xy, specifying z1 as g to the z or g to the z, and sampling a random bit. And then the goal of the attacker is to compute this bit on input of g to the x, g to the y, and zb, as well as the generator and the prime. And that is it. And your task for the homework is to identify what the relation between those three is. But just to add the intuition to that, the discrete logarithm is the adversary's capability of computing the exponent. The computational Diffie-Hellman assumption is seeing two group elements and then computing g to the xy, where xy is the product of the exponents of the two input group elements. And the decisional Diffie-Hellman problem or assumption is that it should be hard for an attacker to identify whether the attacker sees either g to the xy for two elements gx and gy, or just some random group element that is independent of x and y. Okay. So finally, just a note to close the chapter of Schnorr signatures from last week. I don't go into the proof details because the proof is somewhat a little bit more complicated. Security of Schnorr signatures based on the discrete logarithm if function h is modeled as a random oracle. Okay. And now to the final chapter that we open today and close at the end of the semester after the Christmas break. And this final chapter is public key encryption. So the ideas of public key encryption is very closely related to the idea of symmetric encryption. The difference is just that we still have Alice and Bob. And now Bob first generates a public key secret key. And we sometimes call this AKA. Well, let's do the order the correct way. So SK is the first output, public key PK is the second output. And we sometimes call this decryption key and encryption key to actually refer to what those keys are used for. And in case we use signatures and public key encryption together, we have two key pairs. And then if we want to separate them, it is easier to call the one thing decryption key and encryption key, and the other one signing key and verification key. So SKVK and DKEK, just for differentiation. Now, Bob produces this public key, this public encryption key, and Alice can use this key to encrypt messages to Bob. Bob receives the ciphertext and can decrypt the ciphertext with his secret key. So, concretely, the syntax is that we have a gen algorithm that, without an input, produces some decapsulation key and some encapsulation key. The encryption algorithm takes an input of an encryption key and a message and ciphertext, and the decryption algorithm on input of the decryption key and a ciphertext deterministically produces a message. Correctness is again straightforward. What is the correctness?
The probability that the decryption of SK and encryption of PK M is M.
Exactly. Does anybody have an idea of how we could define security for public key encryption? Any idea? Yes, so when we think about attacks, it's super powerful to derive the secret key from knowledge like the public key or ciphertext. But if our scheme is so weak that this is the security that we care of, then it is a problem. For that reason, we have seen stronger security goals that we would like to achieve for the constructions that we consider in this lecture. So if we have our attacker had on ourselves, then we care about breaking such strong fundamental property. But if we want to study meaningful security goals, this level of security is far below the bar of acceptance. But we have learned other notions of security so far that we could maybe adapt and apply to public key encryption. So what security definitions have we seen that are applicable? Negligible. Yeah. So, what does the attacker want to guess?
Well, it's the factorization of the key pair.
That is again a very weak security goal, in the sense of the attacker would be super strong if the attacker would be able to factorize. If we talk about RSA, public key encryption, factorize the modulus. But we want something stronger. We want stronger security guarantees. We have seen them for other types of encryption before. Indistinguishability. What is the alternative to indistinguishability? Yeah. So one-way security.
One-way security.
One-way security or IND security are the security goals. And now if we think about how we define security, we know that there are five steps. So far we have covered three: syntax, correctness, security goal, adversarial capabilities. And what type of adversarial capabilities have we seen for encryption? I don't know where the microphone is gone. There it is. Sorry for everyone in the camera. Chosen plaintext attacks and chosen ciphertext attacks is correct. So those two things here on the right side are called adversarial capabilities. And those two things are called security goal. So there are weaker securities, like security goals like identifying the key, and there are weaker adversarial goals like seeing no ciphertexts. And it is extremely strong to break such a security goal, but a scheme that only offers this type of property is actually pretty weak because it doesn't give us any guarantees about the confidentiality of messages. And for that reason, when we want to build something, we care about the property that covers our payload, roughly speaking. So we want that the messages are hidden. And if only it is hard to identify the secret key with just learning the public key, we have no guarantees about the messages. And for that reason, This is what we want. Okay, so let's just quickly write down IND CCA security. IND CCA security for public key encryption and a challenge bit B. How would that look like? What can the attacker do? Yes, please. Okay. Can we make this the adversary more independent in the sense that we don't have to give that the attacker? Can the attacker do that themselves? The public key is public. Exactly. So we give the attacker the public key after generating it. So we first generate a key pair. And then the attacker can produce ciphertext themselves. So chosen plaintext attacks are covered by just seeing the public key. Check. Okay. What can the attacker do in IND CCA security still? Obtain the messages from decryptions. So the attacker learns MI as the result of the decryption with the secret key and that ciphertext. What could be a possible challenge that the attacker wants to solve? No. M0 and M1, the attacker sees the resulting ciphertext. So if the length of message 0 is the same as the length of message 1, we encrypt under the public key message B, and the resulting ciphertext is given back to the attacker. And then we still have our decryption oracle, and now after the attacker sees the challenge, we have to be aware of the fifth component of defining security, and that was identifying them, specifying the big forbidden sign and identifying the trivial attack. What is the trivial attack that the attacker can perform? Querying the decryption for the challenge. So the attacker again can ask for decryptions. And now if the attacker queries CI prime equals C star, then we don't give the attacker any information. But if this is different, then we give the attacker the decryption of that ciphertext, which is message MI prime. At the end, the attacker makes a guess, and we stop our game with the return bit B prime. So for completeness, we write down the trivial attack. Step one. Who can specify it compactly? What is the trivial attack? Sample two messages. Yeah, that makes sense.
M should be the M0, I suppose.
Yes. This one here is M0. Ah, thank you. Left and right problem, thank you. Okay, decryption. C star. Shortcut notation for that would be M prime. No. Is this correct? If M. In principle, yes, but I want to make it beautiful. In principle, that is true. Yeah, this is correct. Advantage PKE. So the advantage of an attacker is defined as we always defined it. It's the absolute value of the difference of the two probabilities. The IND CPA, CCA security game for the public key encryption scheme is executed, but first with bit the challenge bit B equals 0, and then the same with the challenge bit being 1. So, we would like to have practical public key encryption, practical in the sense that we have long messages, super long messages ideally, and the length of the message doesn't have a strong impact on the performance of encryption and decryption. And for that reason, the typical construction that we use is so-called hybrid encryption construction. Hybrid. Which means that the ciphertext is PKE encryption with the public key and some random key. And this is in an encoded way concatenated with symmetric encryption under that same key and the message, where the key is randomly sampled from the key space of the symmetric encryption scheme. So long messages being encrypted with a symmetric encryption scheme is somewhat easy and efficient. Okay, so this construction is pretty natural and it is used everywhere on the internet, also locally on your computers whenever you want to compute something with your public key on your computer. And since this is the typical way of using public key encryption, we simplify the idea of public key encryption a little bit and call it key encapsulation mechanism. So, and this is the third chapter of today, a key encapsulation. Mechanism discussed in the Katz-Lindell book on pages 412 and following. The idea is almost identical. To public key encryption, again, Bob generates a key pair, sends the public key to Alice, but now the encapsulation algorithm is defined slightly and subtly different, which is that the encapsulation, or the encryption is now called encapsulation, and this encapsulation doesn't take an input anymore. It just outputs two values, a symmetric key, and a ciphertext that contains this symmetric key. And it is not necessary that this key is really contained in that ciphertext. The only part that is important is that when when Bob receives that ciphertext, he can decapsulate using his secret key, the symmetric key from the ciphertext. And there are schemes, for example, the Elgamalchem, in which we don't have to explicitly put the key into the ciphertext, but rather we have a ciphertext that, in combination with the public key, produces, or with the public key, we produce a ciphertext that belongs to a key, and using the secret key and the ciphertext, we can come back to that key without having the key explicitly stored in the ciphertext. So, although it is probably obvious, let's quickly write that down. A chem is a special form of public key encryption for encapsulation of random symmetric keys. The syntax is just as expected. The gen algorithm produces a key pair of a decapsulation key and an encapsulation key. The encapsulation algorithm on input of the encapsulation key produces a symmetric key that is encapsulated in a ciphertext, and the decapsulation algorithm on input of the decapsulation key and a ciphertext outputs the symmetric encapsulated key. Okay, I just go over those things a bit faster because it's just a repetition with minor modifications. The correctness of a chem is defined as the probability that the decapsulation on input of the secret decapsulation key and the ciphertext outputs key under the condition that the encapsulation algorithm on input of the public encapsulation key output the key and the ciphertext, which should be one. For all honestly generated key pairs. And now, especially for public key encryption and for chems, so we could have defined that for public key encryption a couple of seconds ago as well, we will see that sometimes, especially for the LWE-based post-quantum secure public key public key encryption scheme, we don't have perfect correctness. So there are schemes for which the probability that this decapsulation is successful is not 1, but 1 minus delta for delta is small. And of course, 1 is not 1 minus delta, but I hope this is clear. Okay, security. Although we don't call keys plain text, really, the definitions stay the same. So we use one-way or IND security under chosen plain text attacks or chosen ciphertext attacks. In particular, the attacker in chosen plain text attacks can't really choose the plain texts, in particular for chems, but the attacker can see ciphertexts for the execution of the encapsulation algorithm with the victim's public key. So just let's write that down for INDCCA security, and you can generalize that to the remaining three cases directly. The attacker again gets the public key for the honestly generated key pair. Then the attacker can query the decapsulation of ciphertext. The attacker can query a challenge and sees some output. Does anybody have an idea of how the challenge could look like? Let's look at the syntax again. This goes too far, but this is sufficient to see the syntax again. Whenever we have seen keys being output somewhere, symmetric keys being output somewhere, which property did we want to have from those keys? Remember that pseudorandom generators output keys, pseudorandom functions output keys, key derivation functions output keys. Yes, please. Okay, so how could the challenge look like? Okay, so what should the, this is correct, so what should we do here? No, the adversary doesn't do anything. What does our game do? I will just write down what you said, which is we compute a key and a ciphertext as the encapsulation with the public key, and we sample another random key, and then we give the attacker some key KB, and the challenge ciphertext. This is the challenge for a chem. The attacker can continue to query the decryption oracle or decapsulation oracle in the CCA game. And again, we check if CI prime is not equal the challenge ciphertext, then we give back the key KI prime, which is the decapsulation under the secret key and the ciphertext CI prime back to the adversary. And at the end, the adversary outputs a guess, and we stop our game with that guess. And just as before, the advantage of an adversary playing the IND CCA game against a chem is defined as the absolute value of the probabilities of playing that game with challenge bit 0 or 1 and respectively outputting 1. Okay, so we come back to our construction, hybrid public key encryption. More about that in Katz-Lindell on pages 411 and following. So concretely, the public key encryption has a gen algorithm that is just the gen algorithm of the chem. The public key encryption algorithm on input of the public key and a message first encapsulates with the chem. And then it uses the encapsulated key for the symmetric encryption of the message. So the full ciphertext is the composition or the combination of the two ciphertext components, and we would just return the full ciphertext. The public key decryption algorithm takes as input the secret key and a ciphertext. It decomposes the ciphertext into its two components, decapsulates the symmetric key from the first component using the secret key, and then decrypts the message with the symmetric encryption scheme using the decapsulated symmetric key and the second component of the ciphertext. Then we return the message M. So the idea is pretty simple, and interestingly, we can prove nice security guarantees for that. So the sketch of the theorem that I would like to share with you is that if the chem is IND CCA secure with respect to the chem's IND CCA security, and the symmetric encryption scheme is IND CCA secure with respect to its IND CCA security, then the public key encryption scheme is IND CCA secure with respect to its definition. And we can weaken the requirements and then also weaken the result. So if we instead have only IND CPA secure chem and IND CPA secure symmetric encryption scheme, then the result is still at least IND CPA secure. So we put these two components together, and they basically inherit their or combine their security guarantees, especially if both of them have the same security guarantees in terms of IND CCA security, then the resulting public key encryption scheme is also IND CCA secure, and the same holds true for IND CPA security. So this is great, and we will actually see that it is really great. It is useful for, at some point, starting with IND CPA security on both of those components, putting them together, using that with some form of transformation to yield something that is IND CCA secure, and then we come up with something that is IND CCA secure. Yes, please.
I just noticed you might not want to stand there because the lamp seems at the ceiling, seems to be in better shape.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that is true. I will be careful. So yes, we will see that these two steps here, they will help us for the generic transform from coming from weakly secure schemes to a strongly secure scheme, which is the actual goal that we have. This is something that we will look at next week or the second next week. Are there any questions about that? Because otherwise, I will use the last 15 minutes to start with a concrete chem. a concrete scam that most of you have probably seen already, and the concrete scam that we talk about today, 5, is the Elgamal scam. So the Elgamal scam is just a form of rewriting the Diffie-Hellman key exchange. So for everybody who forgot what the Diffie-Hellman key exchange is, a quick repetition of that. The Diffie-Hellman key exchange developed in 76 starts with two users, Alice and Bob, sampling exponents X and Y, and then sharing these exponents with each other, the group elements with these exponents, so G to the X from these exponents, and G to the Y. And then both of them compute K as G to the XY, K equals G to the XY. And this, as a more general concept, is called non-interactive key exchange. Nike. I don't remember whose PhD student Tahir Elgamal, I think it was either Whitfield Diffie's or Martin Hellman's, but I remember that Elgamal was a PhD student of the two of them, and his idea is turning this non-interactive thing that can go parallel into a sequence where basically one starts and the other one follows. So the Elgamal scam then uses a system-wide parameter set, which is the group in which we compute that is specified by the generator and the prime. And then the gen algorithm samples an exponent, computes the secret key as X, the public key as G to the X, and this is the key pair, secret key and public key. The encapsulation using the public key works as follows, and this is what I mean by first Alice does something and then Bob does something. So Alice does the part of the Diffie-Hellman key exchange without knowing that anybody else will ever respond to her, and then Bob, in this case, already knowing what the public key of Alice is, will do his part of the Diffie-Hellman key exchange. Computing his exponent, then computing the resulting key. And in this case, using a hash function in between. And then the ciphertext is just g to the y. So the decapsulation algorithm takes as input the secret key and the ciphertext, and it just returns the hash of the ciphertext raised to the power of the secret key. So for correctness, we see that C to the SK is the same as G to the Y to the SK, which is G to the Y times SK, which is the same as G to the SK to the Y, which is just the public key to the Y, which is the key, or which is the input to the hash function. Okay, since we took a bit longer today in the exercise, and I anyway was able to talk about the AlgamalChem already, we end this lecture before the Christmas break here. And while we have the Christmas break, you can think about why we want to use a hash function before we output the key. Are there any questions? Great. Then thank you very much for this first two-thirds of this course, and I'm looking forward to see you next year. Have a great Christmas break.